Hello and welcome to the show. I'm Martin Willis, your host, and we have a good show for you this evening. We have Peter Robbins coming up. He's going to be talking about a lot of interesting topics. And we also have Alejandro Rojas coming up, but only for a minute. There's some audio issues we try to work out. So I want to thank everyone that supports the show. Anyone can do that at $2 or more a month. All that information is on podcastufo.com. Again, we are moving to Tuesday on June 5th, Tuesday nights from then on out, and that's 6 to 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. Nothing will change for the podcast listener, except you'll get your podcast a day early. That's the only thing. All right, so we're ready to begin. Alejandro, what's going on? How are you? You can hear me, right, Alejandro?
I'm doing good. Sorry, yeah. You keep coming in and out, kind of like you're on another planet or something, but you probably are.
I am, But anyway, just wing it, man. Just go ahead and tell us what's going on in the UFO world.
Okay, some cool things. So a couple of things. First of all, just my own personal news. The other day I got to interview Peggy Whitson. Now, she is an astronaut who we're talking about who has logged the most time in space. When it comes to U.S. astronauts. So 655 days, I think. And then her longest stint out there was 300 days or 289, actually. So just short of Scott Kelly's, who was there, a little bit longer than that. So, so it was a lot of fun. Of course, I asked her about a lot of stuff. You'll be able to read about it at Den of Geek even this week. But I did ask her about UFOs. And I tweeted about it in Facebook so you guys could see it. But essentially what she said is she doesn't know much about UFOs, but that there's a lot out there and it's a big universe and she doesn't think anything's not possible. So she's open to the idea, which was kind of interesting. But that was about all she had to say about that.
Now, Alejandro, did she talk about any ill effects from being in space so long?
She did. We did talk a little bit about that, and I can't remember the details right now, but that will be in a story that I'll have coming out probably next week at Den of Geek. So we talked about Scott Kelly a bit and some of the bad effects that he had, but she essentially talked about one of the things that she talked about that they're working on that they don't have a solution for yet is bone density. So I guess your bone density can return, but your bone quality cannot. So you do have some sort of deterioration of your bone. But she is hopeful that, and they're working on perhaps different drugs or things that can be taken that will help keep that from being an issue. So that was one issue that, I was not aware of that she brought up with me as an example of what she feels is one of kind of their major hurdles for a long time, humans spending a long time in space, but that it's something she's confident that will get rid of.
Alejandro, I'm going to hang up on you and try you back. See if I can make that work. By the way, I'm going out to Chicago tomorrow over the Memorial Day weekend. Hope to see my good friend Sam Maranto out there. He's probably going to be stopping by. We'll see. Looks like we're having a Skype problem with Alejandro. And I believe, Peter, how are you?
I'm fine.
Thanks. I think it's Alejandro's end on Skype because he's not even answering. You hear me clearly, don't you?
Just fine.
Are we going to get through this, Peter?
Yes, we are, Martin.
Okay. All right.
Even with a bumpy start.
Yeah. All right. So I apologize to the listener. We're not sure what happened to Alejandro. We're back with Peter. And Peter Robbins, we met up in Maine. Boy, I'm telling you, like 5 or 6 years ago, something like that.
That's right.
And we've kind of been staying in touch. We've been staying in touch ever since, through good and bad.
Even when you were in Russia.
That's right, yeah. And it's been a while since you've been on the show. I'm really glad to have you back.
I'm glad to be back, Martin.
Yeah. And so, Peter, for the person who has not heard you before, can you give them the background story. And I want you to tell, you've told it before on the show, you had a sighting very young. And if I remember correctly, you forgot about it. Is that right?
I worked very hard to forget about it at the age of 14, yes. Essentially, it involved myself and my sister Helen. We were playing outside of the house that we grew up in a very lovely village about 30 miles east of Manhattan, where I was born in New York City, but my parents moved us out to the suburbs. And it was just a beautiful late morning in June in the early 60s. We were two kids goofing around, clear blue sky. And one of those times in a small town where there's absolutely nothing going on, no cars going by, no ice cream truck, no other kids playing. We were just 6 feet to the left of me, and I caught vision, immediately called her attention to it as five silvery white disc-shaped objects, not round, but oval, like if you take a dinner plate and you tip it and it becomes like an ellipse. They were in a very precise V-type formation. They were not shiny like stainless steel, more like, you know, subdued. We could clearly make out regular detailing around the perimeter of each one. That was the way that at an appreciable different distance you might read windows on a conventional airliner. And it was a particularly innocent time, and I was a particularly innocent kid. For those that are old enough to remember Leave It to Beaver, that was about my speed. I was a mega nerd. I collected stamps, bugs. I read a lot. I wasn't into sports. And obviously, it was a more innocent time. My only thoughts up until that moment about flying saucers was that they were real in the movies that I would sometimes see on a Saturday afternoon with some of my geeky little buddies. And I saw some great black and white B-movies back then. But I guess I intuited the adult message about them, that they didn't really exist. But there they were. And there was no ambiguity. They were round. They had no appendages. And I went through an immediate reaction that I've since chronicled with, I'm sure, several hundred people over the decades, that I've come to call the checklist reaction. You look up in the sky, and you see a thing or things, and you immediately rattle through in your brain everything they're not. Airplanes, kites, helicopters, blimps, balloons, birds, flotsam and jetsam, reflections from the ground, strange-shaped clouds. And I kind of hit the wall. I experienced a moment of loneliness that was incredibly deep. And with it came the realization that if they were real, and the adult world said they most certainly were not, then everything I thought I knew might be open to question. I was in adolescence, being run by my hormones, wanting more than anything to be taller, to have better hair, to have cooler clothes, to not be wearing glasses, and most of all, to have a girlfriend. And I thought very seriously, if I ever talk about this, word will get out, people will make fun of me, and that part of my life will never happen. And I'm not really joking. I started to run into the house to tell my mother. I was knocked out or passed out. I got up, went into the house, walked up the stairs on an intuition that my sister would be there. She was in her bedroom with her back to me, looking out the back window. I thought, private moment. I went into the kitchen where our mom was making us lunch, and I told her, and I didn't remember it because I, again, put it out of my mind for more than 14 years. I joke with people and say, if I had other repressed memories in childhood, I don't remember them, but this was the one. And once, I should jump ahead for a moment and say, once the memory did come back, and I more than confirmed it with my sister, over the next few years, I voluntarily and with great curiosity underwent hypnotic regression with a hypnotist that I knew, ultimately with Bud Hopkins, one of my mentors and a dear friend, who I worked for many years as his assistant, and another mentor, a tough, no-nonsense New York City police detective who had been trained in hypnotic regression for criminal investigation, but was also a crack UFO researcher. And the words that I said to my mother were, "Mom, Helen and I just saw some things in the sky that looked like flying saucers from the movies." I should say here that my mother, although she did not remember this many years later when Helen and I sat down with her and my dad to talk to them about this, she made an extraordinarily wise decision. She looked at me seriously and didn't say anything. And I thought to myself, this is the way grown-ups look at each other. I have interviewed more people than I can remember who, as adults, reflect back on when my kid came to me and said something like that. My reaction was, "Oh, honey, you just thought it looked like that." Or a child who has grown up reflecting on, "My parents put me down, you know, either because they couldn't handle it or they didn't believe me." But my sister later that afternoon said, "Do you want to talk about this?" And I said, "No." And within a matter of weeks, I had, however we do these things, Martin, not even convinced myself that it didn't happen. I forgot about it. And absolutely nothing rattled it loose until 14 and a half years later, when that memory came roaring back in undeniable fashion. And I was compelled to telephone my sister after thinking through what I would say, and had at least the foresight to say, "I've remembered something from childhood, and I need to know what you remember. But I feel if I tell you what I remember, I'll never know. You'll say yes or no. And I'll never know in my heart if you really had the same memory." And I decided to set the scene. The weather, where we were standing in relationship to each other on the front lawn, the time of year it was. And she stopped me mid-sentence and said, "Stop, I know what you're talking about." Confirm the memory, except she wasn't sure whether it was 5 or 6, which we very quickly worked out the next day, because that afternoon I did a painting of 6 of them so that I could hold my hand over one. When I showed it to her the next day, and she realized it was 5 because it was a very precise balanced V, so it would have had to have been an odd number. And then she said something to me that changed my life forever, which was, "But there's more, and I don't know if you're going to like it," and went on to describe what now I would say I've heard variations on, very close variations on, not dozens, but I'm sure several hundred times over the decades, of memories of somebody being taken aboard a craft. This was more than 40 years ago that we had this discussion. And the term gray was not being used, but she described archetypical grays accompanying her, a tall one, then being on a table, being examined. And my career that I had dreamt of since I was young, of being an artist in New York City, began to lose meaning to me immediately. And I resented the hell out of it. That was all I wanted to be. And I was in the process of beginning to live that dream. But something obsessed me from that point on, was more important, and it was this subject and this work, and here we are talking about it all these years later.
Peter, when you said it came rushing back to you, what triggered that? What in particular made that happen?
Yeah, that's a very important question. I think a combination of things. I, as a painter, was teaching painting at my alma mater at the time, the School of Visual Arts, figure drawing and painting, and general painting. And as is part of your job as an instructor, you hire models, often figure models. And I had a figure model that I had really fallen head over heels for, and asked her out after we were done with our 3 weeks of work. It would be very inappropriate to do so before. She told me that she had a boyfriend, but I think kind of feeling a little sorry for me, said, but I did something recently that I really got a lot out of. It was called EST. I had never heard of this or Human Potential Workshop, but I thought, whatever it is, I'll do it. And who knows, maybe she'll come around. She did not, but I had done it some weeks before and was kind of opened up in a way that I hadn't been. Also, this would have been in February of 1975. I lived down in New York's Chinatown in an off-the-beaten tourist strip area, more working-class Chinese. And in the old days, before Mayor Giuliani banned fireworks or officially cracked down on it, they looked the other way up until then. It's a 5,000-year-plus part of the tradition of Chinese New Year. You don't sleep much. It was 48 hours of explosions and smelling cordite. A former girlfriend of mine, who I remain friends with, had done an extraordinary thing for me. My grandmother had saved several dozen drawings I did from the age of about 6 up until about 14, the time that this had happened, and gave them back to me. And Peggy, who did layout and paste-up work, and in the old days it was on acetate, said, I've got a lot of acetate from my last job. Let me take those drawings and encase them in acetate with electrical tape so they won't break up. Some of them are on manila paper and fairly fragile. And I was going through those drawings that afternoon. Again, nothing with the subject matter, but the time frame. I think most important of all, my mind was just ready to deal with this memory.
So it's nothing really in particular that jarred it other than going through what you were seeing, going through a period of time where you were doing drawings and then you looked at the drawings again and that brought you back to that time frame, and that's what made you, that triggered the memory? Am I getting that right?
You didn't come through very clearly on that last part. Say it again.
So you're saying that that's kind of exploring your past is how that kind of triggered that?
Really? Well, again, I think I'm making just an educated guess here that it was a combination of things. Having done a workshop that I didn't sleep much through, a lot of ideas being presented to me, a little sleep deprived over that previous days because of the Chinese New Year, looking at drawings that I had done from that period. And again, most important, I think my mind was just ready to deal with it, and the memory came roaring back.
I see. Wow. And so it's funny how you're not the first person that's told me that they've pushed the memory away. There's so many people have said that. And yep. I'm sure you've talked to a number of people that have done the same thing.
Indeed.
And I think that's when there's any like major trauma in someone's life, you can either do that or not.
And it happens regularly with much more and very tragic conventional traumas. The death of a loved parent, abuse, psychological or sexual, any number of things that one would naturally want to put out of your mind as a young person.
I've heard the saying, if you push it down, it'll come out sideways. So, and that's for about anything. So, so time goes on. You worked with Bud. We did have a question come in from the chat. I'm sorry, not from the chat, from email earlier, who actually wanted you to talk a little bit about working with Bud. And Bud Hopkins, interesting man, great man. And I follow his artwork. I really like his abstract work. I see it come up at auction all the time.
Yes.
But anyway, I know you're really, really close friends with him, and he was a real loss to the community when he passed away. Yes. But someone wanted to know what your more interesting moments were working with him.
Well, there were many. The memory returned in 1975. Bud and I met in 1976. when he published his very first article on his very first UFO investigation, which I read, was extremely impressed with his methodical following through on this case, with the fact that he was a wonderful writer. The New York art world is fairly small, and I knew there was a late period abstract expressionist by that same name and same spelling, whose work I'd seen in a group show a few years before. And I found him in the phone book, and I cold called him, introduced myself as a fellow artist with an interest in this subject. We met for coffee a few days later and sat at his kitchen table down in the Chelsea district in New York, talked about art, life, and UFOs. Not without some irony, the title of his wonderful memoir, last book that he wrote. And I had no idea it'd be the first of hundreds and hundreds of such talks at that table over the next decades. This was still 5 years before he published his very first UFO book, Missing Time, which really was a game changer, exploring the abduction phenomena, which overall was the last thing that most ufologists wanted to be associated with at the time, the ridicule factor of just being an adult who studied UFOs was rough enough without discussing or focusing on the occupants. And after that book came out, as a painter, his life changed considerably, and he became quite well known in the field of UFO studies. But in 19, and I began to work for him part time as people began to write to him. It accelerated after 1987 with the publication of his true international bestseller, Intruders, the story of a young woman who lived in Kokomo, Indiana, who had lifelong experiences and focusing in on a very particular aspect of it. She is still a dear friend, and I still stay in contact with her. I responded over those decades to several thousand letters from people around the world, around the country, always with a handwritten note. Bud insisted on that, and ultimately began to assist him in investigations besides filing and sitting in as a witness on regressive hypnotic sessions that he had been very well trained to conduct. But as to your the question, if there was one case that was the most compelling, the most memorable, the one that I was most involved in, that began in 1989 with a letter from a woman named Linda who lived in Lower Manhattan. And it was not actually until around Thanksgiving that she came in to actually sit down and meet with Bud. The case was the most extraordinary one I've ever studied, I've ever been involved in, I've ever seen so much credible information around. And it became known as the Brooklyn Bridge UFO case.
Yeah. Wow. And, yeah, I know exactly what you're talking about. For the listener, I'd love to go into detail on that case, if you would.
Yeah. The event that sent us into a life-changing investigation, and it lasted 6 years. The book Witness, the True Story of the Brooklyn Bridge UFO Abductions, was published in 1996. And Linda, as is the case with people who have these experiences, became aware one night that she was levitating above her bed in her nightgown and was then floated through a solid glass window, I believe 12 stories up, with a number of small beings, taken into a craft, which then took off. This is all happening within very close proximity to the Brooklyn Bridge on the East River, and the craft dived into the river. And then the story continued further out on a beach on Long Island, and that was just the beginning of it. Linda remains a very dear friend. We're back and forth sometimes several times a week. She's a remarkable woman, and the thing that really got to me as a very pragmatic investigator, and Bud was too, was Bud began to get letters from people in different parts of greater New York who had observed this. Now, it happened about 2 in the morning, but New York never sleeps. And downtown, there's a lot of businesses going on. The letters were all in different handwritings, different postmarks. Most of them contain drawings. And as two trained artists looking at drawings that were done with effort, with seriousness, with high intention by so many different people, and seeing the same shapes, the same color schemes, the same descriptions, the same shock of, I thought they were making a movie. What happened, Mr. Hopkins? Can you tell us? I think it's one of the most important books and one of the most challenging books that will ever exist in the abduction literature. And for anybody who's a serious student of the subject or just interested in jumping in to an extraordinarily well-researched and investigated case, this is a must for your library.
Now, wasn't there someone, I want to say like a government witness. There was some type of witness.
There was somebody who I was sworn to secrecy for some time, who Bud actually met with, and Linda certainly met with, who was at the time the Secretary General of the United Nations, a reason that many skeptics immediately dismissed the story. It can't be. Therefore, it isn't. Therefore, it's delusional or a lie or what have you. But indeed, it was. And he was downtown, possibly on a liaison. He had two security people with an affair with a woman or what have you. I don't know what he was doing there at 2 in the morning. But the two security people became very involved in the story as well. And one of them, once again, you can make this stuff up, but nobody did here, had been brought together with Linda when they were children, and they remembered each other. It's an incredibly emotional story, and it's a good thing Bud took a full 6 years to back it up with the kind of evidence that you would find in a capital case in a court of law. The whole abduction phenomena is so difficult to wrap our heads around. I have been looking at it from different angles, and with Bud, I had the privilege of being a bug on the wall, at his shoulder, working directly with, speaking directly with so many individuals that had had this happen, speaking with family members, medical and mental health professionals that had worked with these people who at a certain point threw their hands up about any possible remotely conventional explanations governing this phenomena. But it is real. It happens to more people than most of us are comfortable even thinking about, and it continues to happen to them to this day.
Strange. So after, you know, Bud's gone, did you stay involved in any part of that aspect of this field, or did you just move on your own?
No, absolutely. I got involved because it happened to my sister. And I realized that it was very important work. Being a humanist and having the right temperament for this, having worked for 8 years in New York City as a crisis intervention volunteer and shift supervisor on the busiest suicide hotline in the United States, I am good working under stress with people who are sometimes at their wit's end. It just continued as a thread in my life, and it does to this day. Not a week passes where I don't hear from somebody who knows that I will keep their confidence, be a good listener, respect what they're saying, do my best if possible to refer them to an appropriate professional if there's one remotely in their area, or reassure them that they are not crazy. And we lost Bud in August of 2011 to cancer at the age of 80, and no day passes where I don't miss him.
Right. One thing I want to make clear to the listener out there is when you say you're kindly working with Bud and you're kindly helping people, you're not doing this for money. That's the thing that people get confused about. A lot of people think that, you guys do this for the money or something like that. And it's kind of a joke, isn't it?
It is, and it would be funny if it wasn't so insulting. However, in 1989, Bud founded a nonprofit foundation called the Intruders Foundation. It had several mandates to work with and assist people who had had these experiences, to support them in every way possible, to have outreach programs, bring speakers to New York on the subject, and to do what we could to educate a broader part of the public. This was all volunteer work for me. I made my living as a painting instructor, a painter, and doing whatever. However, there came a time a year or so later when a wealthy supporter, whose name I know, but I don't know if it's fair to say, gave Bud several thousand dollars to continue the work. And Bud said, "Congratulations, you are now a professional. I'm going to pay you $8 an hour." So I did get paid $8 an hour for almost a year.
Wow.
That salary was up to $10 an hour, and I'm not hiding the fact. And then we ran out of money, and for the rest of his life, I continued on as a volunteer.
Oh, that's really funny.
Yeah. Yeah, so I wasn't it for the money.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. And I hope I'm not calling attention wrongly, but the books behind you, are those anything to do with UFOs and research? Or is that just other types of art books or something?
No, most of the books in my study here, and I am a bibliophile. I've loved books since I was a kid. I collect books. But most of the books in this room that I do my work in are related to the subject. And let me just take a moment.
This is for YouTube listeners, of course. That is a big library. Wow.
It's actually just a painted backdrop to make me look small.
Yeah. Isn't that great? Wow. Thanks for showing us that. That's great. I started collecting UFO books in only about 5 years ago, so I don't have much of a collection. My house has libraries, though, several libraries. So
one of the reasons I think we get along as famously as we do.
Yeah, right.
I wish more people regarded books as we did, and I wish more people read.
I like the look of books, too. I like the look of, like, a nice leather-bound book on a shelf.
Absolutely.
Yeah. I think we're a little off topic, so. So now, what? Tell the listening audience, if you would, how you then carried over, and I want to talk a little bit about Left at Eastgate.
Mm-hmm.
So did I say that right?
Yeah.
Yeah. So, but how did you progress? How did things progress to get to that point where you got involved with Larry Warren and started on that venture?
In 1987, it was the 40th anniversary of Roswell, the Kenneth Arnold sightings, the 40th anniversary of the modern age of UFO sightings. And the Mutual UFO Network, MUFON, the largest UFO organization in the world, based in this country, had a particularly memorable conference. It was held at American University in Washington, D.C., and I attended it with a friend, and among the speakers was this young man who purported to be a witness to a case that first broke in this country, first broke in England where it happened, and around the world simultaneously, of course, in late 1983. And I had followed the case ever since. It still stands as Great Britain's best known and I think most significant UFO incident. Mm-hmm. And his talk was very compelling. We met, I should say, I wasn't a speaker there, but I was at a panel discussion about the abduction phenomena that was being chaired by Dr. David Jacobs, a historian from Temple University and a well-known abduction researcher. And I was there in a double spirit as the assistant of Bud Hopkins and as somebody that grew up with an abductee in the family. My future co-author heard me and decided I was the person he wanted to write a book with about his incident. And we met in the hallway rather inadvertently on the Sunday. I decided I wanted to do an interview with him. I didn't know he had any intention of writing a book. But I was 12 years into the work at that point and starting to think about a more in-depth project. I had had articles published by that time. I certainly had spoken at conferences. And I probably would have ended up writing a book, not surprisingly, on the abduction phenomena, and possibly about working with Bud and the like. And he came to my apartment the next weekend, made his proposal. I took it at face value, accepted, and we began to work on a book. That took us 9 years until completion and was published in 1997.
9 years. Wow.
Yeah. It did moderately well in this country. Rarely do UFO books really take off here, but it did very well in the United Kingdom. And over the next years, I lectured on the subject, certainly with him on my own, continued to research it, continued to return to the area. I was fascinated by this particular incident and all of its permutations. And it was not until a little over 2 years ago that his account started to unravel. I went into some very serious denial about it. I rejected the possibility that I could have been taken in by somebody who was telling me half-truths, confabulations, lies, as well as whatever of his account was true. But people started to do their own investigations and started to write to me with increasing frustration until I began to look at this material, and much to my embarrassment, horror, sadness, I realized that at the least a good deal of what he had told me that I had believed, that I had not double-checked on certain things, that I had taken his word for, were unfortunately true, and that he was in no way the person that I thought he was. Beginning a period of time which certainly was the roughest I've ever had in what I'll laughingly call my career in ufology. I have spent a good part of the last year and a half making amends with as many of the people who I ultimately wronged or cut off as friends or misled our readers about. In some respects, I will probably never live it down. And that's the way it is. I've been through worse in my life. But when it all finally blew up early last year, I had to call it to the attention of our publisher, who republished this book in 2005 in an expanded edition. Alex Dackey is his name. He's a lovely man. He runs a company called Cosmo Books in New York City. We had become good friends over the years. And it was with a lot of sadness I had to tell him that he needed to conduct his own investigation. And if he came to the same conclusions I had, that this book needed to be removed from publication, which saddened me more than I can say. I will always stand by the parts of the book that are mine, that were not influenced or working on information that I believed was real and was not. And in fact, they began their own investigation last October. They completed it in January, at which point a press release went out that the book was going out of print. It will never be in print again. Before that, I, on my own, removed two follow-up books that I wrote, once again, supporting my former co-author's account. One, a digital book that was put online, 450 pages, most of which was just raw documentation, and a follow-up book that really was focused on defaming the deputy base commander, Charles I. Halt, whose life I helped to make rather miserable for more than 25 years. I am glad to say he and I have, he has accepted my apologies. We have been in contact. I only wish him the best. He knows how I feel about what has happened. And life goes on.
Wow, Peter. First of all, that is gracious of you to apologize. And, you know, I've talked to...
No, it wasn't gracious. It was the only thing to do. I'm sorry to say many people are not in the habit of admitting publicly that they have made extremely embarrassing error, and that's a shame. Well, it's partly a guy thing, but that's not the way I was brought up. It was the only decision to follow.
Well, you know, you were betrayed. You're only human. You believed in someone, and they betrayed you. And I'm really sorry for that. On all those accounts that I've heard Charles Halt say, you know, he never remembers Larry being there. So let me try to get this straight to back up just a little bit. Do you believe that Larry just went by all the hearsay when the people came, you know, his fellow military people were talking about the story behind the scenes? Do you think he just picked up everything and then he went public with it? How did all that come about? How did he come up with his side of the false story, so to speak?
Well, that's something we could do quite a number of shows in a row on. At this point, Martin, I don't even know what to think about so much of what he put on the record. By some accounts, he was out there. By others, he was not. The fact that he knew certain things does not necessarily mean that he was involved in them. But I don't know. And as I wrote in a very long polemic about this that anybody interested can read by going to my website, Peter Robbins NY, as in New York, PeterRobbinsNY.com. Front and center, you will have an opportunity to read a very long response piece that I wrote on this and published last June. I have to leave this work to, and I again, I should doubly say here that this does not affect the reality of the incident, which most certainly happened, was extraordinarily significant, involved many credible witnesses. First among them, one of the witnesses on the first night, John Burroughs. There were three nights, Larry alleging he's involved on the last night, who continues, I think, to lead this work and who spoke at a conference in Woodbridge, England, the closest town to where these events happened, just this past weekend, along with other preeminent people involved in investigating the case. I am burned out on it, and I feel I've lost, and rightly, the right to participate in continuing research in this particular event, which at this point is fine with me. I will always hope to return to that area. I'm hoping to next year. Some of the dearest people in my life live in the area. It is a fascinating part of England, only about 70 miles from London. Anybody interested in the subject planning a visit there, they are welcome to contact me through you. I will help them if I can to connect up with some friends there who can take you to some of the locations. It's an extraordinarily important event. And
yes,
I'm just not part of it anymore, except in the respect that we're talking about.
Yes. So, Peter, when this was going on before you confronted Larry, did you have like a gut feeling like something was wrong, for that you just tried to push away for a while? Or and what actually made you say all of a sudden say, OK, all right, I have to confront this?
Mm-hmm. If one reads the book, and copies will always be available as used books, or some of your listeners may have copies.
I have a copy.
Yeah. When you get to the part in the second half of the book that is my first person account, you will read early on that I was unsure at times, but I didn't trust my intuition. I felt the story was that important, and the rationale that carried me through to support him in so many ways for so long, in part revolved around my belief that he was very troubled by this, that he's suffering post-traumatic stress, that there were people out to bring him down, and he is nothing if not convincing, passionate, in fact, very charismatic, very likable when he wants to put that out there. But it really came to a head a little less than, for me, a little less than 2 years ago at a conference we were both supposed to schedule to speak at in Glasgow, Scotland, where literally in the last few days leading to it, and it was going to be the first time we had spoken together on the same stage in a decade, which the organizer, a great woman in Glasgow named Alison Dunlap, who worked long and hard to raise the funds to bring us there, and did a lot of work to create an event that was going to culminate with an hour and a half talk by us, that a woman posted a note to him on an appropriate Facebook thread that she might be in the audience, and if she did, if she was, that she was going to ask him a question that he might not like. His response, not uncommon for him, unfortunately, was to threaten her physically.
Really?
The conference was held at the University of Glasgow, and she, I think very appropriately, brought it to their attention. He was banned from speaking at the conference, lied to my face about a number of things, and then in follow-up, when I began to question him about specifics, he refused to answer any of my questions, started to threaten me, and that was it. Enough already. You will read what I wrote to him, imploring him to deal with certain issues in his life and have the courage to, you know, admit that he had misled people, but he would have none of it. And I haven't been in touch with him in, well, certainly more than a year and a half in any manner.
Is he, do you think that he's just denying everything and just standing his ground?
I think that it's what he continues to do, and frankly, I could care less.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, what's really the shame about this, for the most part, is all the time and all the effort that you put into this because you believed in someone, you know, and that's really not your fault. It's really, you know, well, anyone can tend to do that. And, you know, I've had conversations with Alejandro about this, and, you know, it's a shame that you were taken in, and I'm glad that you realized it and you did something about it. So,
now,
good for you.
Anybody that knows me knows my character. The only reason I got involved in this so many years ago was to try to find out what had happened to my sister, to try to understand the implications of this truly anomalous phenomena for humanity. And I am the kind of person that can be fooled. What I would have never imagined, what I didn't imagine, which one of the things that shocked me so much, was that by the time he met me, he already intended to deceive whomever it was he was going to be working with, and by extension, our thousands of readers as a result. Some of the documentation, his official documentation that he gave me, had been altered, which I simply didn't suspect even for a moment. And there are other issues outside of the subject itself that reflect character problems that, for me, always enter into the matrix of who you are. I've had people say, well, the fact that he has dealt in rock and roll memorabilia that he has forged, which is an absolute fact going back many years,
I saw the pictures,
as well as the provenance. the forged provenance for it, and he's very good at it. That shouldn't reflect on his account. Well, you know what? I disagree. When you don't tell the truth, you don't tell the truth, and it can affect any area of your life.
Yes, I totally agree with that. We don't want to stay stuck on this subject. I do believe that is a fantastic case. It's right up there in the top five. I've said that
very much so. Very important case.
It's very convoluted, too. And part of the convolution was possibly the Larry Warren, Larry Warren part of it. But anyway, that's over now. I'm glad also that you did what you did with your publisher and removing the book. And, you did things right, Peter, so that's all you can do. You did things right. So anyway, we'll move on from that. We have we had some questions come in, and let me just pull one up that came into my email, and we will check chat later. Also, we're going to take calls a little bit later.
Mm-hmm.
Carrie wrote this question into me for you. With privately run groups being established, such as UFOTOG, UFO Data, if they are able to capture scientific data that would prove anomalous activity in our skies, do you think it would be would gain interest from traditional scientific groups and promote interest in the study of the subject?
That's an important question, Carrie. Yes and no. One of the things I've delved into over the decades and keep returning to is the power of ridicule relative to this subject, which cuts across every line. It can affect everyday folks and very famous folks. Nobody likes to be made fun of, and in certain careers, it can help to destroy your career. Politics, science being among them. Most people who think of themselves as, say, a serious contributing member of our greater scientific community, quote unquote, know that there's nothing to the subject, because if there were, they'd know. They're scientists. Ask any of them if they've ever read a book by Donald Kehoe or Bud Hopkins or Jacques Vallée or John Mack or
RuPaul.
Exactly. M.K. Jessup. And of course they haven't. They're busy people and they're not going to waste their time on this stuff. Some of them have closet interests, but to go public with them, no matter what the alleged evidence suggests, and groups like UFO Update, I think, do us a service overall. However, the internet at large is a double-edged sword, and it's one thing to show what looks like brilliant footage of a truly anomalous craft, and then when you start to dig down and find out that you really cannot pin down the person who is alleged to have taken the photos, getting information on the location, any other witness testimonies, photo analysis for it, these things begin to fall apart. So I think we're still some ways off on that. It may take some extraordinary science fiction level event to wake people up, especially in the scientific community. I absolutely understand why they feel this way, having done deep research into the origins of the ridicule factor. And a paper I'll be happy to forward to you that delves into it at length and goes into detail about people who were presidents, presidential candidates, leading political figures, billionaires, important people in society, so to say, well-known people, if not important, and how every one of them was compelled to back down sooner or later because of personal possibility of humiliation or the possibility of their career going down in flames.
Peter, just stepping back a little bit to the former topic, do you feel as though you are like a little trigger shy into doing another book, or do you think you'll write more?
Oh, no, I'm working on it. Yeah, thank you. I'm working on a book right now, and I'm glad to say I've just accepted an invitation to begin writing regularly for one of my two favorite online related publications called Outer Limits Magazine.
Oh, wow.
That comes to us from the UK.
Mm-hmm.
It's right up there with one that's been going on for longer called Phenomena Magazine. And I encourage all of your listeners to subscribe. The subscriptions are free. There are no strings attached. They don't do data mining. But I am working on a book now, and yeah, it has made me maybe a little trigger shy of accepting an extraordinary account at face value without doing, well, I'm a different person and more experienced than I was 30 years ago when I got involved in this project. Most of my work, though, outside of this has never really focused in on an individual account. They have to do with moments in post-war history where I can research it in an archival manner through libraries, through out-of-print books, through interviews with people who knew people. And that is more fail-safe. It's longer. It's not as sexy. It's definitely more time-consuming. But I produced a lot of good work in that spirit, and a lot of it will be in this anthology book that will be out sometime later this year.
Right. We're going to put the number up on the screen, Peter. So we're going to invite people to call in if anyone wants to give a call and ask Peter a question. So we'll get that up in just a second here. What do you think, since this is something you and I have not had a chance to really talk about, but what do you think has changed over the last several months since the December 16th article came out, you know, about the Pentagon researching UFOs? What do you think has changed? Do you think it's a different world now?
It's not a different world, but it definitely kind of hit an angle and is moving off in a slightly different direction. What you're referring to, for those who are not aware, is last December, the New York Times published an article going into detail about a classified project that was funded by Congress to the tune of $22 million, with leading congressional figures seriously involved in it, even though the story begins as a small box story. It begins on the front page, which is very rare for the New York Times. I am probably the only person you will ever meet who has read every single article, editorial, commentary, photo caption, letter to the editor, political cartoon about the subject of UFOs, anomalous disks, flying saucers that was ever published in the New York Times. So I am familiar with the way that they work. It was followed on the interior section, making it a full page, with the accounts of two respected fighter pilots. And we have had credible accounts from fighter pilots in this country and around the world for decades. Similar scenarios, and a genuinely unknown object is sighted over your territory. It fails to respond to a request to identify it. Jets are scrambled. They get close enough to see often that it is not anything conventional, and they are ordered to fire on it. In every case that I am aware of where they have been, their electronics go out. They make a quick move to return to base. As soon as they turn around, everything comes back on. In many cases, they're ordered to go back at it again. Same thing happens. I think there were people, credible people, people with a public profile, as well as a lot of regular folks who are waiting for something like this to appear in print, in whether, you know, you're a liberal or conservative, whether you love the New York Times, whether you hate the New York Times. It is a major world publication. It's it kind of gave more credence to how seriously certain elected officials in the know are about the subject. the fact that the funding was made available, as opposed to some mysterious black project that we can speculate on. And I think it has caused more people to allow themselves the luxury, if you will, of saying to somebody else, you know, I think there is something to this subject now. I wasn't sure before, but now I'm more interested. One thing I can tell you, speaking at conferences and networking with people regularly here and abroad, especially over the last 6 or 8 years, every year, more and more people, and interestingly, many of them, in the 50 to 70 demographic, 20 and 30-something folks overall do take the subject seriously, but they've got a lot of other things on their plate. What I'm trying to say is more and more people care less and less what other people think about what they think about the subject. And that is important. That is a sea change for me. And I'm seeing and speaking to more and more of these people, again, via social networking, people who write me on email, contact me on my Facebook page, or who I meet and get to know sometimes at conferences here and abroad.
Yes, Peter, we had a caller call in, but I didn't want to interrupt you. So just to let the people out there know, if you call in, what I'm going to do is you'll come in, but I'll be putting you on hold, and you're just going to have to wait until I introduce you. So I encourage the caller to call back. And so the change, there was actually something I wanted to talk to Alejandro about, because George Knapp did this report with his iTeam report the other day, where they, going back to the Tic Tac back in 2004 on the Nimitz, he was able to get some documents that were very, very interesting. They were talking about the data that was used, the equipment that was used. One in particular, it could track a golf ball at 100 miles. They were all focusing on this object, and it was reacting. It was reacting to Dave Fravor, the pilot. The one thing that was very clear in this, which was really interesting, because there was some confusion, I thought there was when the item, the Tic Tac, so to speak, hovered, shot down to like 50 feet above the water, it was actually hovering over an object down in the water that looked about 100 yards across. So this is all documents that came out, government documents, that George Knapp is working on.
Yes.
So, and that's available. You can just search Google and you can see it. It's actually on my website. I posted the video of the report on podcastufo.com if anyone wants to check that out.
In terms of serious investigators, and I don't mean self-trained investigators, writers like me, I mean real journalists, you can't get any better than George Knapp.
I agree. Yeah, I agree. Hats off to him. And he does not like compliments, by the way. I don't know if you've ever noticed that.
Sorry, George.
Okay, I'm just typing in. If anyone wants to call in, you're just going to have to wait until I bring you in. But so what do you think has changed as far as the overall attitude? I think I've noticed a number of things. For instance, the FAA actually released audio, in regard to that Arizona UFO, which is unheard of.
That's
so
correct.
I think that there are some things changing a little bit.
Yes. Yeah. The thing is that frustrates some of my colleagues, especially dear friends who are very active in what we call the disclosure movement, is that they're not changing fast enough. Things are changing arithmetically. They change when you see something that, like me as a kid, radically alters your perception of the world and the nature of truth. Or if somebody you know shares something with you, and again, a person who you absolutely implicitly trust, but they're changing, you know, 5, 7, 9, 2 people at a time. They're not changing geometrically. I remember early on in his pioneering work as a a true godfather of the disclosure movement, my good friend and colleague Steve Bassett and I chatting years ago, and Steve said, you know, you're old enough to remember the anti-war movement in Vietnam War. I certainly do. I was an art student in New York at the time and very much against the war, and in the streets protesting it at different times. And that movement began to really change geometrically. After Ramsey Clark left as Attorney General, and I think a week later emerged as one of the leaders of the anti-war movement, making Lyndon Johnson, I'm sure, especially unhappy that week. When the legendary Walter Cronkite went on CBS that night and made it very clear he also felt that this was no longer viable and a wrong war, our parents started to join us, young men who were draft eligible, and the women in the field who cared about us as well. I don't think the disclosure movement will hit that mark again unless something completely unpredictable, extremely dramatic, that is undeniable in an international sense, happens.
You know, I agree with you on that. I've said that a number of times similar. But I also think that if for some reason that dramatic event happened and it was undeniable, I think now we've had so much softening. For instance, just that one particular article coming out and some more people looking into it that never did before and all that. I think that I think our life will just go on. I think that people will accept it a lot more freely now. I don't think the world's going to come crashing down and religion failing and all that. I think it's just going to be accepted and it's going to be not forgotten, but it's we're going to live with it.
Yes and no. I think people of faith will remain people of faith. However, when you and I and like-minded people discuss this, one thing I often observe is that we forget that we live in a bubble, that our views, long entrenched in many cases, surrounded by people who have similar beliefs, make us forget or not be aware the degree to which we are still very much a minority, and that the great majority of other people in this country and around the world relative to this subject are doing their best, hopefully, to pay their bills, raise healthy kids, hope that there's Social Security or its equivalent health services when they need them, live in a decent society that cares about its people, and otherwise sleepwalking their way through this subject. I think there will be a potential tremendous upheaval, and it's one of the reasons why I'm very circumspect about, you know, power to the people, everything now, disclosure on everything, which was the way I felt decades ago when I got into it. But if you really care about people and how they are overall going to react, that's something you can't allow yourself to forget. I'm not sure what the solution is, but that's a fact.
Right, right. Yeah, well, I think a lot of things have, like, headed toward, you know, I heard a UFO researcher said disclosure has already happened, basically, you know, and I think maybe that's, it's happened to the extent it's going to happen, I don't know. But I think all the way going back to Kepler, you know, just discovering all these possible Earth-like planets, and just the fact that we have more and more information coming at us all the time that just seems yes. It's so almost impossible for us to be alone.
I think that's a fair statement and an understatement. Over the past decade or so, even the most conservative, recalcitrant, denying astronomers and members of the space-looking scientific community have conceded that there are not just millions, but millions and millions, potentially, of Earth-sized planets about the same different distance that we are from a similar sized star to the sun. If you are a religious person, it sets up the potential for the miracle of the creation of life by God. If you are a secular thinking or scientifically oriented person, it sets up the building blocks for the primordial ooze that the first one-celled animal was created in and, you know, gave birth to a two-celled animal, a creature, whatever. So, that is good. But still, I think part of what is keeping those folks stuck, besides ridicule, is for some people, it's just hard to think about giving up the role that we humans have come to think of ourselves in. Even if we are the poorest, most powerless person, we're still a member of the most complex and amazing species ever to evolve. And maybe they're us a million years from now. They are entirely different non-carbon-based life forms.
Silicon.
You know, they're from another dimension right next to us, you in Maine, me in New York right now, enjoying the show very much, and have always been with us, and a combination thereof.
Yeah, yeah. We have a caller on the line. Caller, what's your first name and where are you calling from? Can you say that again? We got a bad connection.
Yes, my name is Mike, and I'm calling from Winnipeg. Can you guys hear me?
Mike from Winnipeg?
Yes, sir.
Hi there. How are you doing? Mike. If you could speak up just a little, that'd be great.
Sure. I was wanted to know Peter's thought or position is regarding the ET phenomenon and whether or not there is a connection or association between it and consciousness or, you know, mental telepathy.
Great question, Mike. It's become really very popular to backpedal the ET hypothesis, although I think it's one of the most conservative ones now in looking at these other intelligences. I've come to feel, and based on evidence that I've seen over the decades, that certainly some of what we call UFO activity is representative of advanced technology under intelligent control, and that it's not much of a stretch to consider that if they are as technologically advanced compared to us as they may well be, that they may well also be more advanced in terms of consciousness. Within the abduction phenomena, we've observed hundreds of times in that research area of research specialty that they, for lack of a better term, I've never been comfortable with the term aliens, these other intelligences, can certainly affect our perception. So I think that your question is very well founded, and I think that there is genuinely something to what you're asking.
Hey, Mike, thanks for the great call. Do you have any other question?
No, that's it. Thank you. Great show.
Thank you, Mike.
Thanks. So the line's open if anyone wants to call in. Peter, what do you think is the and I'll try to let you know if we have a caller calling in. So what is your what do you think is the biggest challenges that the UFO community has right now?
I think part
He's
of
laughing.
It
yeah.
is working together more cohesively. We human beings, and we're no different in this area of study, clashes of egos, people putting forward their own passionate beliefs as empirical fact is a big problem for me. No matter how respected or well-known or how many books you sell, if you make a statement, as one person has some time back, that all aliens are good or that a specific number are visiting our Earth now, for me, that's complete bull nonsense, and I don't care how many deep sources you have within the intelligence community, the deep government, whether you're the president of the United States, the head of Russia, the supreme rulers of six alien races all rolled into one being, there are certain things that you cannot know in anything remotely provable. This only hurts the work. The sideshows of claims of things that I consider somewhat outrageous just based on a document that has no provenance, that may have been, you know, secretly spirited out of official circles with a very sincere account from somebody who will look you in the eye when they tell you about, you know, their mission on Mars, et cetera. Let me put it this way. When I was about 12 years old, through my love of film and reading, I was introduced to a character named Sherlock Holmes, a wonderful creation of an English writer named Arthur Conan Doyle. Hold it while I terminate that.
Hey, I think we have actually, Peter, we may have a caller on the line, I believe.
Let's go for it.
Do we? Caller, are you there?
Well, I've been called worse things before.
Hey, Lee, it's so weird. Lee, I never accepted your call, so I never saw you unless I did two at once. So, Lee Spiegel, how are you?
That's one of the reasons why you and I can never be real good friends. Because you don't accept my calls. Hello, Peter. Hello,
Lee.
Martin.
Hi, baby. Hey. A big hug to you.
Well, you know, I just couldn't help myself because when I heard you say the words primordial ooze, oh my gosh.
I wasn't talking about you, I swear.
It was like, it's like you were talking about where I live.
Hey, yeah, if you're in Queens, that's my birthplace, man.
That's
yes,
where he is.
I know. I'm watching the ship for you here.
Thank God. So. How are you doing, brother?
It's nice to see both of you, and I just wanted to say that I actually feel, and I'm very, very sure about this, disclosure has happened. And I get really crazy when I hear people say not only that there's no evidence, but disclosure is imminent. Oh, come on, folks. Yeah. It's like all that anybody really has to do is do some legwork. And I'm not saying you, Peter, or you, Martin, or any of the other researchers who I respect. It's like if people want to believe in something, that they're going to believe in it, whether they do any research on it or not. But when it comes to UFOs, and if we're being visited by anybody from somewhere else, and I don't care where they might be coming from, I don't think that's important. But there's tons of evidence out there. The naysayers, the hard-nosed skeptics, the debunkers, you know, they're in it for their own agenda. But in terms of agendas, there is no real overall agenda. I think that there's plenty of evidence. People just have to go out there, do the legwork, read the documents, go into historical records, do some research, folks, and you will find stuff that will open your eyes. There. That's my piece.
Yes. For those who are not familiar with my dear friend and close colleague, Lee Spiegel, once again, I am a self-trained investigative writer. Lee is a journalist.
Yeah.
And one of the best ever in this field.
Absolutely.
Well, thank you.
Thank you. It's a fact.
And we may, it's possible that Lee might be coming up with another person on my show, but I don't know if Lee has that confirmed yet. Does Lee?
Well, we're working on it.
We're working on it. Okay.
We're working. And I don't mind saying, you know, we're talking about my good friend, James Fox.
Great.
Whom I am co-producing the next UFO documentary that will be coming
Wonderful.
Up soon.
Wonderful. I'm jealous.
Oh, well, don't be. Just be as hopeful as I am that this thing is going to be what we hope it will, and it will open people's minds or change people's attitudes just a little bit about UFOs. Yeah. We're not attacking the government or the governments of the world about why there's been so much secrecy and conspiracies and lying against the public. Yeah. That's not where we're headed in this particular documentary. And we've got some interviews that will blow everybody away. I will tell you that are already in the can, and we have more to get. and we're working very diligently. I'm going out to California in about a week, and I'm going to be there with James for the whole month of June, working
awesome.
On the script of this documentary.
Please send him my best wishes, and I will not now say let's get together when I'm back in town next month. I would rather be in California, I think. But James Fox is among the finest documentary filmmakers ever to tackle this subject. I'm working with you. I am already very excited. Do you guys have a working title that you can share?
I can give you that much tonight, sure. It's called UFOs, What We Now Know.
Excellent.
It was 701, or that was the title at first, but things have changed. A lot of people still contact me wondering what's going on with that. But so that's the new working title.
Yeah. And for any members of your audience who don't know even the reference of 701, when Project Blue Book, the Air Force's 22-23 year study of UFOs, when it ended, after looking at 12,000 plus cases and reports about UFOs, they ended up with 701 cases that were completely unexplained and unknown, and so. Some of those cases are what we're dealing with, because frankly, I don't care about the other 12,000 more, because you got to take a stance. You've got to put your focus on what's really worth looking into. Yeah. And I personally don't want to spend any time looking at objects that were obviously the planet Venus that was moving around in the sky. It just doesn't make sense to me. And I also want to say that I'm a big admirer of Peter Robbins. Peter is one of the more dogged, and I use that word lightly, dogged investigators of a variety of subjects. And I know he's been all over the Rendlesham case in England. And your audience probably knows who Peter is. He's out there. He's doing great work, and I appreciate him. Always have.
Yeah. Hey, Lee, thanks so much for the call, and I hope to be talking to you just in a couple of weeks.
Yes, sir. Me too.
We will
check
it out.
Yep. Wonderful hearing your voice,
you,
Lee.
You too, Peter. Take it easy.
All right.
You too.
Good night,
See
Lee.
You later this year.
Okay. Bye-bye.
All right. We have another caller on the line. Your first name, and where are you calling from?
This is Abner, calling from Florida.
Hi, Abner. Welcome to the show. You have a question for Peter?
Well, two things. I remember I spoke to Lee about the whole disclosure thing, and I do also believe disclosure has already happened. Everybody just needs to open their eyes a little bit. The question I have for Peter is, he mentioned about his sister, and I'm very curious as to what brought him to the conclusion that he feels his sister was abducted or may have been abducted.
Well, my sister and I, she passed away in 2000, were always very close in age, in interests. As adults, we were roommates. She was a brilliant artist, a singer-songwriter, a writer. She's one of the most honest and straightforward people I ever knew. She told me this at a time more than 40 years ago when I had never thought about this as a possibility. Over time, the things that she told me, sometimes word for word, came up in dozens and dozens and dozens of cases that I worked with Bud Hopkins on. She never, unlike me, never forgot that day and never forgot the memories. But as she said to me 14 and a half years later, when I asked her why we had never talked about this, she said, "Do you remember that afternoon when I asked you if you wanted to talk about it and you said no?" And I said, "Of course." And she said, "You know, you're my brother. I love you and I respect you." And one day led to the next week, led to the next month, led to the next year. As time passed, she worked closely with that extraordinary police detective who was a pioneer in using regressive hypnosis in criminal investigation, and with Bud Hopkins to delve into her experiences with more depth. In terms of abductee accounts, and obviously you might think I'm lacking certain objectivity here, and that's fair to say, but it is, her account is as credible and as well backed up also included an implant, which we could spend a whole show on, an anomalous object, in her case, way up in her nasal cavity, that she sneezed out as a child, which became something I remembered because it was the only time growing up that I was awakened in the middle of the night by my parents moving around and Helen in her bed with her pillowcase quite red with she had sneezed this thing out. She had asthma and was got all kinds of allergies. She saw it, had kind of a girl's reaction of ick, and kept it in the Kleenex and threw it away. The implant phenomena, though, is as real as the chair that I'm sitting on, and there are quite a number of specialty researchers in that part of the field. More, I don't think I can give you, Abner, but I did and do take her case as seriously as the case that I went into in detail earlier in the show about Linda and the Brooklyn Bridge UFO abductions and so many other people.
Thank you for that, Peter. Abner, thank you very much for your call.
Yes.
Thank you.
All right. Peter, did you, and I'm sorry that your sister passed away. I remember we've talked about that. Did you have her go through any of the work with Bud, actually?
Oh, my God. I didn't have her do it. She did it. They became very dear friends. But she was one of more than 800 people that he worked with in regression.
800?
Oh, yeah. I know because I logged in all those audio cassettes and kept it was all back in the day done in analog format. I witnessed more hypnotic regressions than I can even recall now at the request of the individual and Bud, obviously.
Oh, speaking of that, we have a call coming in at the same time. So that was perfect timing for that person to call you.
Yeah.
Caller, your first name, where are you calling from?
My name is Lindy, and I'm calling from Tennessee.
Hi there. Welcome to the show, Lindy.
Hello. I can't believe I got through. That's cool. That's the first time I've even turned in. I'm loving your show.
Thank you.
I wanted to point out something here. I am 59, so I'm one of the last of the baby boomer bunch, and we grew up watching our people getting assassinated and civil rights, you know, fight and Watergate and one bit of corruption after the other. And it just seems like it's just gone from bad to worse over the past 57 years. My concern, I hear people saying, yeah, there's been disclosure, but I think what people like me, after seeing all this crap that's taking place, I see that there has been a grave abuse of Americans and humanity in general by this cover-up and some shadow government. And I'm not into all the deep, dark conspiracies as far as that goes political-wise, just the fact that it looks to me from the outside looking in that this has been something used to subvert our very system of laws that are meant to protect we the people. If I understand where I'm going with this, this is the full disclosure I'm looking for.
Yeah.
Because if we don't, you know, get the cancer out of the system, it's going to kill all of us. It can be used to do anything, to justify this, that, or the other for national security or whatever.
Yeah.
And I'm tired of being lied to. I feel like we've been lied to for decades. And I'm tired of it. I'm really fed up. I'm a grown woman.
Yeah.
I'm not a 5-year-old child. You tell me that there's aliens visiting here, I'll say, hey, buddy, my name's Lindy. Let's talk. I'm not going to run and hide under my bed and freak out. I'm a grown woman. I can deal with it.
Yeah.
And I don't like being treated like a child.
Thank you.
And I'm tired of the government hiding it.
I couldn't agree with you more. And for me, your view goes to the core of the real problem here on Earth regarding this subject. In the summer of 1947, through an extraordinary pounding away by our media, quietly, tacitly, not interfered with it, to put it mildly, by our government, the American people, and by extension the Western world, were simply made to understand and accept really without much question, that all of this nonsense about visitations from space were all explainable in conventional ways. For those of us who are serious students of the subject, the thousands of pages of fully authentic, gilt-edged, formally classified documentation from every imaginable agency, military, intelligence, governmental offices that counter that and show how concerned we were about the potential for panic. I think what they're really talking about, talk about national security, national insecurity. Starting at the get-go that summer in the post-war years, America was such a different place. We were the good guys. We really were the good guys. We had helped make this world free from fascism, and the Marshall Plan was doing something extraordinary, helping our former enemies rebuild their societies and ideally go on to a better world together. Well, that hasn't worked out so well in many respects. But I think those people that were involved in the initial wave of secret keeping, they were all powerful white guys who had a vested interest in being perceived as powerful. This was at a moment when the power balance in the world was shifting. The Soviet Union was our next big enemy. The next war could be nuclear. Paranoia of a different sort was engendering itself, and it was seen as the right thing to do to lie through your teeth to the American people. For me, the birth of our national security state, which ufologically I think is brilliantly laid out in the first two of three volumes by our, I think, most respected UFO-related historian, Richard M. Dolan, in his books, UFOs and the National Security State 1 and 2, is that first irritant, that had to be covered up, did not have to do with nuclear secrets. It had to do with keeping this secret. And like a pearl, building layers and layers and layers until it was this huge thing at the beginning, in the middle of all of it. I think your view is absolutely right. I admire your attitude about it. I think there are a lot of people who will be able, despite what I said earlier about, you know, fear of the unknown and possibility of panic among some people, who will be able to stand up and say, okay, I always suspected this, or if the worst was possible, you know, we'd all be taken over or melted down now like in a bad science fiction movie.
They would have gotten us already.
Yeah,
I think we're a generation that grew up with Star Trek.
That's right.
Okay? That blasted my brain open. Wow, what a cool concept. Mm-hmm. I want to get out there and meet these other beings, because to me it made so much more sense than we're the only one.
Yeah.
Well, and I think that people all around, me feel the same way. And what it looks like to me, this control, this cover-up, is meant more to maintain that power over people.
That's right.
It's not about protecting us.
Here's two reasons why they're doing it. Number one, because one of the central secrets, after 70-plus years, is how little we really know and understand about that. And that is something that fragile egos that want to be seen as powerful cannot deal with. The other thing, brilliantly pointed out decades ago by our senior, most respected ufologist, Stanton T. Friedman, now retired, retiring from the field after more than 50 years of slugging away, one of the greatest people ever in the field, is if indeed it was announced that we are not alone in the universe, we're being visited by other beings, that they, some of them maybe are, you know, want to work with us and have been watching over us or concerned about us, other ones that may be malevolent, I think they have the potential of being anything that we are, that we, for the first time, as human beings on Earth, God forbid for people who live by a code of nationalism and controlling the rest of us by where the line is drawn in the dirt. And you're on this side, I'm on this side, you're the other, you're evil, I don't understand, you speak a different language, you have a different colored skin, we might, horror of horrors, start to think of ourselves for the very first time together as human beings rather than Americans, Russians, Indians, Canadians, Venezuelans, Catholics, Muslims, Buddhists, Jews, men, women, And that would be devastating to the forces that like to move the chess pieces.
That's right.
I agree. That is very well said. Very well said.
Lindy, thank
you. I have enjoyed talking with you. I'm glad to meet you. I think you and I can sit and we can talk tonight.
I can say too, Lindy. A pleasure
thanks.
Speaking
thanks
with you.
Thanks a lot.
And bye thank bye. You for your clear thinking.
Yeah, thank you, Lindy.
Bye-bye.
Bye. So the lines are open if someone else would like to call in. And speaking of Stanton Friedman, I had him and Kathy Martin on my show back in December, and it's
the
first
all-time best.
Yeah, and it's the first YouTube video that I did a podcast on that actually hit 100,000 views. It just hit it yesterday, I think. So yeah, and I'm going to get Stan on. I've been communicating, going to get Stan on for just one more time before he retires for a retirement show. So listener, keep your eyes open for that. It's going to be sometime this summer. We'll have some time to do that. So we're going to go about, to make up for the start time, we're going to go about another 15 minutes or so, Peter. Are you all right with that? Yeah, okay, because our start time was delayed. So you mentioned the issues with the UFO field. What do you think is good about the UFO field today?
That we have people with the courage, with the curiosity to say the hell with ridicule. I'm putting myself on the line here. I'm interested in it. I'm not going to not talk about it. I'm reading about it. I'm networking with people. I'm trying to understand for myself with the goal of wanting to make a contribution in what I consider extremely important work. I support anybody who is trying to follow that path. I would suggest that you keep your day jobs and don't do what I do and try to do it full time and pay your bills by doing it. It's very rough going. But there's room for as many people who are willing to put themselves on the line and do the work. For me, that's inspiring, especially when it's younger generation.
Yes. Yeah, we need, it would be nice, you know, going to conferences, you don't see, well, you're starting to see some, but it's there's kind of an aging, you know, conference going crowd, you know, at this point. So it would be nice to see it, you know, get a little younger and more people. I understand, you know, there's so much information being thrown at young people today from all different directions, and everything, you know, everything is built for a very short attention span. You need a long attention span for this field. You know, about the ridicule part of it, you know, it's pretty amazing. You know, I've spoken to a number of people that have no ridicule, and some people have a lot of ridicule. And I'm talking about like in the workplace. For instance, Preston Dennett was on a couple of weeks ago, and he was saying, you know, everyone at work knows him as a UFO guy, and it's great.
Yeah.
And I worked with a few years ago at a startup company, and it was for collectibles, but it's still going today. It's an internet startup company. And I had a position there, was advising them and stuff, and it came out that I had a UFO show, and everyone, it was like 30-some-odd people, they all loved it, and, you know, we're talking about it all the time. So it really depends on what profession someone's in and what they're doing and if they get ridiculed or not. As you, as an artist, I don't think you ever had to worry about that part of it, did you?
Not as much. I give you an example, though. About 30 years ago, I had a series of summer jobs teaching in a wonderful program sponsored by the Oklahoma Council on the Arts, working in an area in northeastern Oklahoma where I work with kids. Most of them split between the children or the grandchildren of Phillips Petroleum executives and engineers, which had its headquarters in Bartlesville, Oklahoma at the time, and Osage and Cherokee kids. I was an artist and I was teaching art. And one Saturday afternoon, I had afternoon to myself, I had my loaner pickup truck. I was having a burger someplace in town. And the father of one of the kids that I worked with that year and the year before saw me through the window, came in, you know, very happy to see me, and immediately said, "Pete, you're not going to believe this. I got a call from such and such last night." He said, "You're not going to believe this, but I was tuning through the television channels, and I saw that art teacher, Pete Robbins, on television, and guess what the show was about? UFOs." And he started to laugh as he said it, and he said, "That couldn't have been you, right?" I said, "Well, it actually could have been me, because it is a subject I do besides being an artist." And his face fell.
Really?
And he got very quiet and serious and said, "I can't believe it." And this guy was an engineer, an oil engineer, well-educated, well-traveled, not unsophisticated. His basic response was, "You work with our kids. We trust you."
Oh, my God.
"You know, we think of you as smart." And I said, "You know, well, let's talk about this more." The upshot was he invited me to speak for a club out of, I think it was their local Elks Club, that he called the SOBs. I said, "Look on my face." He said, "The Skeptics of Bartlesville." And about a week or so later, I was their guest at a lovely dinner where we drank a lot and had a lot of fun. And then they put my feet to the fire and started hitting me with questions and dismissing my answers. And by the time the thing that got around to absolutely splitting the room wide open was, without giving the name of the signer, I read two letters, copies of letters that I had in my files on a stationery of the United States Senate, letters to a constituent, to two different constituents from the then senior senator, when the letters were written, not when I did the talk, from the great state of Arizona, named Barry M. Goldwater, who, as many people in the field know, was a reserve general in the United States Air Force and an activist UFO person. And they didn't care about Reagan. They didn't care about other people who I brought up who took it seriously. But when I mentioned Goldwater's name and they got that these were authentic documents, they started arguing with each other. And after a while, it wasn't so much fun. but yeah, I think, again, also, we have to remember that the climate is getting better. It's certainly not, you know, cleared airspace yet, but it is, as I said, more and more people care less and less about what other people think, about what they think about this important subject.
Right, right. You know, there's an interesting question that came up that kind of skims around the topic that we've talked about tonight, and this comes from Carrie as well. In the UFO field, we tend to think about government agencies keeping secrets from the public. Have you ever thought about how much of a burden it would be for the individuals involved in knowing the truth about alien interaction with our planet and keeping the secret from the public? Do you have an opinion on that?
Carrie, I've thought about it regularly for decades. I am one of those people who, and it's not always a good thing, I tend to see both sides of an argument fairly clearly. Even when I come down very solidly on one side, I can still have some understanding and compassion for people on the other side. My best sense, and it's more intuitive than documented, is that people in a number of secret levels who are cleared to know certain amounts of information about this, but of course are not able to talk about it publicly, struggle with it. A good number of them probably want to keep up the status quo because it will be that so embarrassing if we have to go forward and admit that we've been lying to the American public and the world for so long. And other ones who really want to see this come out. And there may be more infighting going on behind the scenes than we imagined. One thing to remember, if we still lived in a world where, say, a president of the United States could do this on their own, and that time has been gone for decades, Harry Truman could have done it. Probably President Eisenhower could have done it. By Kennedy, I don't think so. There's too many considerations. There's too many. You'd have to network. You'd have to coordinate. You'd have to counsel. But let's just say we lived in a world where whoever's president, right now it's Donald Trump. I think who knows what, if anything, he's been cleared to know about this subject. I think each president is informed or lacks information, depending on how the secret keepers and members, key members of the intelligence community feel about them as individuals and as leaders. But no American president would do it because the secret started here. And the moment they said, my fellow Americans, it's my solemn duty to inform you that since 1947, at least, we have been aware, blah, 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 blah. They would be admitting that they had been a co-conspirator along with their Democratic and Republican, liberal and conservative counterparts going back to Harry Truman in the greatest cover-up in human history. And I don't think any world leader wants to take that on themselves, certainly not an American president.
If he did, he'd tweet it out. Don't you think? Probably it'd be a tweet. One of those tweets.
Yeah. We're not alone. And it's huge.
Yeah. All right. Hey, Peter, someone asked earlier if you're going to be speaking like any tour around different areas this year. Do you have any engagements, speaking engagements lined up?
I'm working on a number of them. Right now, most of my time is spent with my dad, who is at very advanced age. I am his caregiver. Oh. He's a great guy. I love him. And that's what I'm doing most of the time
now.
But it's not a hardship. It's just the way it should be. I have a talk coming up in New York State on June 9th, which is a Saturday in the beautiful little town of Orlean, New York, that maybe three of your listeners might be able to get to. I'm right now networking with friends and colleagues in the Midwest and California to bring me to both locations for an extensive series of talks in both places. I've got a number coming up in New England, the end of this summer, starting with the Exeter, New Hampshire UFO Festival and Conference, one of my favorites.
I'll see you there. I'm going to be doing, I'm trying to work it out to do a show there on Saturday, a live show.
Oh, wonderful.
Peter, we have another caller. Your first name and where you're calling from.
Hi, my name is Adam, and I'm calling from New York.
Hi, Adam. Welcome to the show.
My hometown.
I'm happy to a fellow New Yorker calling you here.
Right. You have a question for Peter?
Yes, I do. Quick thought. I've heard that if only one particle, if we had one more particle or one less particle during the Big Bang, that life as we know it would not exist, wouldn't be able to exist. You know, everything would be completely different. And with that in mind, I was wondering if you have heard of the simulation theory and if what are your thoughts on that?
I haven't heard of it, so I have no thoughts on it.
Okay. It's just a theory that perhaps reality as we know it is just a simulation.
Yes, that we are perhaps
in a computer program.
I guess for me, when we begin to debate or philosophize or look into such matters, we're really kind of stringing things together by spider webs. We're working on intuition, myth, belief, longing, hypotheses. Very interesting, but
you don't put much stock into it.
Not even that. I think it's such a huge consideration, and I'm not a scientific person. I've trained myself and I've studied in certain areas to understand basic concepts or gone off on tangents and read papers relative to research that I'm doing, but I don't think I'm very well qualified to answer that question because I don't have enough information to have an informed opinion about it. And a lot of times in life, especially in this area, where after 40 years I know how little I know, I choose not to have an opinion if I don't have enough information to have an intelligent or basically informed opinion with respect.
Well,
Just a little
thought on that myself is I just think there's so many things that needed to happen for there to be life. I mean, just for life to happen on Earth, for instance, like just the fact if ice didn't float, there would be no life. You know, I mean, it's one little tiny little simple thing. And there are so many simple things that made life possible. So, yeah, it's an interesting subject. I appreciate the call. We're near the end of the show. Thank you,
Adam. Give my regards to Broadway.
Yeah. All right.
Have a good night, guys.
All right. You too. All right. So, Peter, can you give out your website one more time?
It's my name and the initials of my home state, Peter Robbins, RobbinsNY.com. And it is sorely in need of updating. But again, relative to the situation we discussed earlier, front and center is a long paper on my feelings about that.
Yes. All right, Peter. Thanks so much. As always, it's a pleasure to talk to you. And I'll be seeing you. Oh, one question came in the chat room. Someone wanted to know if you were going to go to the Philadelphia MUFON convention this year.
As things stand right now, I am scheduled to MC that conference.
Oh, excellent. All right, Peter. Thanks so much. And we'll be seeing you in Exeter.
I'll look forward to it. Martin, always a pleasure working with you. Thank you.
Yes, and thank you. Thank you for the situation that you handled so well with Larry Warren. I appreciate that. You're a fine person. Thank you.
Back at you, brother.
All right. Okay, everyone. So that's it for our show. And we'll be back next week. And we have Grant Cameron on next week. And,
great.
I want to thank everyone that supports the show. And I also want to thank the people that help out. Alejandro Rojas, unfortunately, didn't have much of a show today. I want to thank our guest, of course, Peter Robbins, and Evan behind the scenes, Peggy for helping out with the Facebook page. Remember to like us on Facebook for all the UFO latest news, and that's updated every day. All right, so we'll be back next week. And don't forget, 2 weeks from today, we're going to be starting on Tuesday nights and at 6 to 8, and we're going to be over on KGRA radio as well. All right. Thanks so much. And remember to keep your eyes to the sky.